jaja ori shako eru mole shango mojuba ile iwa lo ba kuso amabu shango yeye
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 that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a powerful compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells the people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
I'd like to do a poem called Billy Green is Dead, and what it does is point out that our concern is still rather shallow. Our community mindedness, our community orientation toward each other is still not what it should be. This is called Billy Green is Dead.
The economy's in an uproar. The whole damn country's in the red. Taxi fares are going up. You say Billy Green is dead. The government can't decide on busing, or at least that's what they said. Yeah, I heard you when you told me. You said Billy Green was dead. But let me tell you about these hot pants that this big leg sister wore when I parted with the alphas. What? Billy took an overdose. Well, now, junkies will be junkies. But did you see Gunsmoke last night? Man, they had themselves a shootout and folks was dying left and right. At the end, when Matt was cornered, I had damn near give up hope. Why you keep on interrupting me? You say, my son is taking dope. Call the law and call a doctor. What you mean I shouldn't scream? My only son is taking dope. Should I sit here like I'm pleased? Is that familiar, anybody? Check out what's inside your head, because it never seems to matter when it's Billy Green who's dead.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
when something is wrong with my baby. Thank you. Something wrong with me. And if I know, I know, I know, I know, I know, I know, I know that she's worried. The same misery. Oh, oh, oh. We've been through so much together. Oh, yeah, yeah. But we oh!
Karigani, Hotep, and good afternoon, my brothers and sisters. I am so glad that you're here, and I hope the answer to the Habarigani question will be that there's going to be some love in here tonight. Sam and Dave, something is wrong with my baby, something is wrong with me. Old school music, but it's very relevant to what we're going to talk about tonight. We got to bring love back into our community. We got to bring it. That's a wonderful song that sort of stimulates that kind of feeling and emotion. I am so happy that you're here to join us tonight. My name is William Rogers, and I am your host. I open with the words of the Honorable Marcus Garvey. A people without the knowledge of their past history, their past origin and culture, is like a tree without roots. So greetings, and I hope that you will be able to stay with us during the duration of this program. We have a very exciting and stimulating guest that's going to be with us, and I'm going to introduce our guest very shortly. But first, I want to do a couple of things. As you know, we are here every Tuesday night from 8 o'clock Eastern Time to 10 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time, and also 7 Central Time to 9 Central Time. And this is a very dynamic program that is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. We are a part of a network of other historical organizations. We are also broadcasting on the timeforanawakening.com network, the timeforanawakening.com network. And that is a part of the blacktalkradionetwork.com. And let me say to you, my brothers and sisters, the blacktalkradionetwork.com is the number one podcast system on the planet Earth. And I'm so happy to be a part of something of that magnificent magnitude. I'm really happy that we are able to do that. Our program is sponsored by Motherland Media Network, which is a system that also has a program here called African Perspectives. And we're going to be tell you a little bit more about what they do and when they air and when they come on. But anyway, I am extremely excited about our topic tonight. We are going to deal with an issue that I guess I'm tempted to always try to be very observant about our culture and our community and what's going on in our world. But tonight, I must admit, the subject matter wasn't quite familiar with as I have gotten information now, and that is the area of domestic violence as it relates to men being the victims of that. And we've been talking about domestic violence here on the Black Reality Think Tank for a couple of sessions. And as a matter of fact, our guest has been a part of some of that discussion. Week before last, we aired a rebroadcast of a discussion because it's such a critical issue. And we want to make sure that our community understands that there are some things that we can do, things that we must do. We must be aware of it. But I had not heard of the area that we're going to talk about tonight so much. And after my research and preparation for tonight's discussion, I see now that this is very well a critical topic. And so we have an expert advocate in this area, and she's going to talk a little bit about what she does and answer some questions about that system. I wanted to also mention the fact that this is a call-in format. Our number is area code 215-490-9832. I repeat, 215-490-9832. And I would very much love for you to call us and to express your opinions, ask a question about this topic. You can do so. Now, I want to also make sure that it's clear how it's done. You call into the switchboard, which is that number, area code 215-490-9832. And I will see your number. You do not have to do anything after that. You just simply hold in place for a minute and let me get to you. And then I will come on and ask you, introduce you and ask you what you would like to tell us, you know, or either what question would you like to ask about our topics. So once you call in to the switchboard and you will be prompted how to do that and what will happen once you dial the number, I will then recognize you and bring you on to speak. And at that point, you will be speaking to hundreds and hopefully thousands of individuals, your brothers and sisters that are out here in the community listening to the Black Reality Think Tank. I really appreciate all of you, too, our listening audience. It has tremendously grown over the last few months. We are able to take a look at our numbers on a weekly basis, periodically, and I will say it has tremendously grown, and I appreciate you finding interest. And also your emails, I'm getting a lot of emails and questions, suggestions. I'm getting suggestions and a few criticisms, which I love it because it gives us a chance to adjust and try to give you what you want. But we appreciate that, and we look forward to you continuing to do that. Our email address is Sankofa, S-A-N-K-O-F-A, underscore B-R-T-T, at Outlook.com. And I repeat, Sankofa, S-A-N-K-O-F-A, underscore B-R-T-T, Black Reality Think Tank, B-R-T-T, at Outlook.com. So we'd love to hear from you. Just email us and tell us what you think. Make suggestions, obviously, for ideas maybe for upcoming talks. And we'd love to do that. I am also very excited about some of the upcoming things that we are going to do. As all of you know, there's recently been a film released on the life of our great and beautiful grand ancestor, Sister Harriet Tubman. And that film, I think, airs beginning this week. And so I am looking forward to viewing that myself and seeing that and looking at its relevancy and its correctness of history. You always have to be aware that Hollywood is strange and different sometimes, so you want to be able to take it and see just how they have handled that subject. And that is an interesting one, too, because now, particularly in light of the fact that, you know, Harriet was supposed to go on the $20 bill replacing Jackson, and there has been a lot of controversy based on the Trump administration's attempt to block that. And some other things. And then there's a group of scholars that have been researching the work of Harriet Tubman for years, and they have come out with a very negative research that is not true. It's really left for interpretation. So we're going to talk about that in an upcoming program on the Harriet Tubman. And we have a guest. We have a young woman out of Dallas, Texas, who has written and developed a one-act play on the life of Harriet Tubman. And she is going to be our guest. And she is also an artist, a visual artist. And she has done several pieces of artwork around that. She is a very strong and dynamic historian and educator. She's a very strong feminist as well. And so she's going to talk a little bit about, you know, her research and what she has done in preparation for Harriet Tubman. And so we really are excited about that, and we look forward to it. And then following that, we are going to have a brother come on who is a poet and a scholar, and we are going to be talking about Toni Morrison and looking at her impact and influence in the literary world. Our guest, the brother, has been an ardent student of Toni Morrison, and he has researched and done a lot of things, and he, like so many of you, have a passion and a love for our dear sister, who is now also a part of the ancestral realm. And so we're going to be talking about the great Toni Morrison and some of her classic works and what she was trying to say to us using fiction through history. So those are two exciting programs I'm really looking forward to doing, Harriet Tubman, Toni Morrison, in the upcoming week. So you can look at our website, which is the Black Reality Think Tank website, it's on Facebook. Go to Facebook and put in Black Reality Think Tank, and you will be able to see some of the things that we are doing. We try to announce those programs in advance so that you would have a chance to be prepared and hopefully listen to those discussions. And then always, if you miss it and you just can't hear it, we have an archive system. And you can go to www.timeforanawakening.com, www.timeforanawakening.com. BlackRealityThinkTank.com. And all of our programs are archived there on that website. You'll get a chance to also see some of the other things that have been being presented through the Time for an Awakening Network, and get a chance to play those anytime, 24/7. You can get the full recordings, and so you will be able to get that done without any delay. So we really look forward to you coming aboard and following through on that. I really appreciate, again, I appreciate all of you and the work that you are doing in following and supporting the Black Reality Think Tank. And don't forget, our call-in number again is area code 215-490-9832. And you just call us and hold on to that switchboard. You don't have to do anything, and I will see your number, and I will then at that point bring you on so that you will be able to hear it. We have a, like I said, we try to do a very open discussion. It's a think tank format, so we are here to discuss and talk and give everyone a chance to stress their opinion and respect that opinion. It's not we're not being dogmatic about anything. We are open to a different viewpoint, and which is good, which is a part of our growing. And that, those are the kinds of things that we really must do and continue to do. All right. You know, as always here on the Black Reality Think Tank, we give honor to our ancestors. We must do that. The great Fannie Lou Hamer says we must always praise the bridges that brought us over. And so we do not fail to do that here on the Black Reality Think Tank. And so we're going to talk about a very dynamic person who has recently joined the ancestral realm, but a very powerful and dynamic scholar. Her name is Dr. Julia Hare. Dr. Julia Hare. The dynamic, motivational lecturer, relationship expert. She was an author, social commentator, and educational psychologist. Dr. Hare was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Dr. Hare has appeared on several television programs offering her expertise and insights on male-female relationships, gender interactions in the workplace, and mate selection, as well as toxic relationships. Whoa, toxic relationships. And matrimonial harmony. She has appeared on CNN and Company, C-SPAN, Tony Brown's Journal, and Inside Edition. Dr. Hare has also spoken before the Congressional Black Caucus, participated in Tavis Smiley's State of the Black Family Conference, and spoke at the annual Essence Empowerment Seminars at the Essence Magazine Cultural Festival that's usually held every year in July in New Orleans. Her written work has been featured in several magazines and newspapers, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Miami Herald. Dr. Hare and her husband, powerful brother, scholar, co-authored a book called The Endangered Black Family, Bringing the Black Boy to Manhood. Powerful book. I read that book years ago, and I'm totally moved out of that. I was working with young black males in a mentoring program, and we incorporated a lot of those ideas in the program, as well as we used them to seek other support from people in proposals and programs that we wanted to do in building curriculums and so forth. They wrote another book called The Passage. Also, The Miseducation of the Black Child, Crisis in Black Sexual Politics, and How to Find and Keep a Black Man Working. Whoa. How to Find and Keep a Black Man Working. And so her, as I said, along with her husband, Dr. Nathan Hare, who has been featured on the Time for an Awakening network previously on a program that airs on Friday and Sunday. But Dr. Nathan Hare formed an organization called the Black Think Tank. It is located in San Francisco, California. Their consulting firm focuses on the issues affecting the black family. Dr. Julia Hare's work has brought her many awards and honors, including Educator of the Year for Washington, D.C. by the Junior Chamber of Commerce and the World Book Encyclopedia in coordination with American University. The Abe Lincoln Award for Outstanding Broadcasting, the Carter G. Woodson Education Award, the Association of Black Social Workers, Harambee Award, the Scholar of the Year Award from the Association of African Historians, and the Lifetime Achievement Award from the International Black Writers and Artists Union. Dr. Julia Hare has been inducted into the Hall of Fame of her high school alma mater, Booker T. Washington High, was given a presidential citation from the National Association for Equal Opportunity in Higher Education, and was named one of the 10 most influential African Americans in the San Francisco Bay Area. During graduate school, Dr. Hare taught elementary school in Chicago, Illinois, integrating music into the students' lessons. Following a move to California, Dr. Hare served as the director of educational programs at the Oakland Museum and later hosted talk shows for both ABC Television, KSFO radio stations. She also served as the public relations director in the local federal housing program in San Francisco. Her formal education includes a BA in music from Langston University of Langston, Oklahoma, a Master of Arts degree in music education from Roosevelt University, located in Chicago, Illinois, and a PhD in education from the California Coast University in Santa Ana, California. Dr. Julia Hare passed away on February 25th, 2019. Dr. Julia Hare and her husband, Dr. Nathan Hare, who is still with us, but has been a very dynamic figure in the past. We had a very good friend, a good brother that has been on our program before. His name is Dr. Marvin X. Brother X has worked with them. He talks extensively about the Hare family. And he has mentioned several times on our program about his relationship with them. And so they are no stranger to us. And as well, my idea for creating the Black Reality Think Tank actually came from the work of Dr. Nathan Hare and what they were trying to do with that think tank. And I do believe in them. I think we should have them. I think more of us need to start some think tanks and where we can sit down and dialogue powerfully. Because as you know, as this the spiritual word said, in the beginning was the word. So we have to talk it out first. And we have to have conversation and develop from the conversation and move forward. We just don't stick to the conversation. We move from the conversation and go into our work. So anyway, Dr. Julia Hare is our ancestral profile for today. Okay, we are ready to begin this dynamic topic and discussion. As I said, this was a eye-opener for me. I mean, obviously, I know that men are abused sometimes and many times, but I think I did not know the brevity of it until I began to look at, you know, some of the things that our host, I mean, I'm sorry, our guest is presented to us. And so I really appreciate her. She has been on our program before, and she has provided some informative discussion and talk relating to domestic violence, you know, involving women. So tonight we're going to talk about men. I'm going to introduce her in a minute. Our subject is I Am So Tired of Being Beaten Daily. Who Can I Turn To? And that is the topic. And this is what, as I said before, is the crisis of domestic violence against males. According to the domestic violence therapists and advocates, 40% of domestic violence victims are men. And the big problem with that is they won't seek help. Many of them won't seek help. So tonight, the conversation is on the Black Reality Think Tank. We'll focus on male victims of domestic violence. Our discussion will center on the what, who, and the why of this major crisis. We will also address the question of why don't male victims seek help. We want to know what is causing that. And then maybe, hopefully, we can make suggestions so that those of you who may know males that are being abused, you can provide them and guide them in the right direction so that they can start the healing process from there. And so I know that we have several people in our audience right now that are listening, that are part of those kind of things, and we want to talk about that. So tonight, our guest, and she's really no guest. She's not a guest at all. She's no stranger to the Black Reality Think Tank. She's just really a friend, a very good friend, an associate, working with her now while I'm here in Milwaukee. And I have really enjoyed working with her so far. We've done a couple of real great things. She invited me to speak recently at one of her workshops, and I was able to do that. They've got some other things coming up where I'm going to be speaking again. So I appreciate the opportunity and the involvement with her. But our guest is the founder of Impact Coalition for Families, and she is the establishmentarian of the first and only certification for domestic violence advocates. The first and the only certification for domestic violence advocates training cohort. And this is the first one ever to be offered at any institution of higher education here in the state of Wisconsin. She has also developed a best practice curriculum that she researched, wrote, had peer review input in this, both across the social science disciplines. And that included both PhDs and domestic violence and sexual assault advocates. Dr. Belcher delivered her domestic violence advocate training program for 6 years in higher education partnership that she established with Springfield College. Dr. Belcher is currently studying for her second doctoral program in educational leadership. Dr. Belcher delivers locally, nationally, and internationally academic information around domestic violence. She is doing so to train and establish family violence cohorts and services. She continues to this day to provide through her organization family domestic violence advocacy training material, teaching individuals, service professionals, therapists, clergy, and community at large in the dynamics of family violence. Best practice for particular type of care, prevention in the first place within the cultural construct for families, and how to be a family violence advocate. She is a dynamic voice. She has published several books in the field of in this subject, and so she's here tonight to talk about domestic violence as it relates to our brothers. Good evening, Dr. Belcher. Dr. Belcher, I'm sorry, let me have you. Dr. Belcher?
Can you hear me?
Okay, now I hear you. How are you doing tonight?
I'm well. Thank you for having me.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much for being here.
I hope you can hear me.
Yeah, I can hear you very well.
I can't hear you. I know we had a little discussion about this earlier, that your system is going in and out. So
okay, and that is, let me make note to our audience so that I can tell you that. We've had extensive amount of rain here in Wisconsin, and so we keep going in and out. I want to let you know that if by chance that we do fade out, I've asked Dr. Belcher to keep talking. Hopefully not. The internet has been blinking, and it's obviously, as you said, it's still doing that now. So hopefully it will not affect us as we begin to conversate. And talk. So if it does, if it does, just stay with us, and we'll come back, and we'll find a way to get on here. And then if you happen to just miss it, then you will be able to go to our archive probably tomorrow or the day after and listen to the entire program, because it does continue to record, even though the internet does not pick it up and you may not lose it. So, okay, Dr. Belcher, thank you so much. Are you trying to say something? Did you want to say something?
No, I'm just saying if it's you that I can't hear sometimes, so I don't know if you're asking me a question, but I'll just continue if I lose you.
Okay. Okay.
saying until you come back in.
Fantastic. Okay. domestic violence as it relates to males. The statistics you sent me, the statistics that it was 60% women, 40% men.
Well, let me just start by saying, October is domestic violence awareness and prevention month. I frame domestic violence as family violence because it's a broader term. But I use those terms interchangeably, but I frame it as family violence. But according to the Center for Disease Control, 40% of violence victims are male. Okay. And that is over 2 million men in America who've experienced severe physical violence or emotional trauma by a spouse or an intimate partner. And 60% of domestic violence victims are women. So while, yes, men are domestic violence victims, but their numbers are less than women victims of domestic violence.
Okay. All right. For our audience, kind of give us a little bit more of a background of that statistics. Who is doing that violence to men? Is it men to men? Is it women against men? What is the breakdown of that? Do you know that? Because I know in a lot of cases with the women, you know who that breakdown is. So what is the breakdown with the men in terms of who's perpetrating that violence toward the men?
Well, domestic violence, interestingly enough, domestic violence of men is something that begins at an early age. According to, I believe I read it in No More and maybe Break the Cycle, they report that over half of men, 53.6%, have been physically or sexually abused or stalked, even in dating relationships by dating partners or experienced their first abuse in sexually or physically between the ages of 11 and 24, mm-hmm. You know, at 53.6% and like 70% for women at that same age. So this thing starts pretty early, setting the stage for this kind of victimization. And so what often happens is you end up with these statistics where you have 1 in 6 men being victims later in domestic abuse situations over their lifetime.
Okay.
Male victims of domestic violence are in heterosexual relationships. They are in gay relationships. They are being abused by spouses, intimate partners, wives, dating relationships, IPV, intimate partner violence, the same mm-hmm. as females,
same as
but in lesser
okay.
numbers than females. Females are still more violently abused, but men are also victims.
Okay. Does the system...
I'm sorry. I'm trying to hear what you were asking me.
Okay, does the system respond to those perpetrators in the way that it does to women? For instance, I had an opportunity to serve as police officer in New York City, and I've said often most of my calls that I can recall during the life of my my work came in domestic violence where men were against women. I very rarely got one where there was a male involved. I did get one once where there was a homosexual relationship, and the partner had committed mm-hmm. violence. But though,
Here's the thing, Dr. Rogers. Here's the thing.
Okay.
This is where it looks a little different for male victimization for domestic violence. What I've been able to see in the research, and it speaks to it, is that there's a correlation here of possibly. What the difference is that when there's male victimization and domestic violence, there are two things happening. There's less resources, okay, for male victims than there are female victims. And by resources, I mean advocates, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a direct lack of trained domestic violence advocates to work with male victimization. Okay, and there are some reasons for that, and I'll be happy to speak to some possible reasons for that. But the fact of the matter is, there is less resources for them, and then there's the second part that's a correlation that maybe why they're not coming forward and getting the help they need. There's the stigmatization of them, as being black, not just black males, but predominantly, you know, black males especially, there's this fear of police reporting. You know, they report they're being victimized by their partner. Who's more likely to go to jail? Who's more likely to believe? And that's across the board as well. There's the issues of you're a man and you let her do that to you kind of thing. So there's the shame thing that they also deal with in not reporting what's going on with them. Mm-hmm. So they may have children. There's a fear that maybe they're going to, you know, lose their children as a result. There's a whole legal system I mentioned earlier. There's many, many reasons why they don't come forward.
Okay.
Maybe they don't want their spouse to get in trouble.
I want to get to that later. Hold on before you discuss the reason why they don't come forward. Mm-hmm. I want to set up first the statistical piece of this to sort of talk about the cause. I want to look at the causes of this kind of idea first. But another question that I wanted to ask as it relates to that, because of the fact that it's a male that may be assaulted by a woman, is there any study done on the dynamics of that? Is that a large number or is that small? I'm trying to get a breakdown of that 40%. And who the victimizer is, you know, because when we do when we look at women being abused, we look at who's doing it, and obviously
right.
Because if you're going to stop it, you got to look at who is it that's perpetrated that. So talk a little bit about that.
There was a recent a 2014 study I was looking at among some others, but this one stood out to me, and it was a Health and Human Services research, and it was talking about. That's, you know, the training and the certification for domestic violence service providers, the lack thereof, and the need for a national standard curriculum and training approach like what I developed for training advocates to meet this resource need. And in this study, it was talking about there being about 36% of women and 28% of men experience sexual and physical violence and stalking by an intimate partner. I didn't really see a whole breakdown. Like, I think what you're asking me is this, what percentage of, say, that 40% of men who are being violated or victimized, what percentage of that is in heterosexual relationships, what percentage is in, I didn't, you know, get that deep into that study, but I can just tell you that it's about 40% of the overall reports of that kind of victimization is by their partners, whoever those partners may be.
Those partners, okay.
And I think what's important for me as an advocate, domestic violence, family violence advocate, is that it is happening to men. I don't really get into which partner is doing it. I don't care if it's a female partner or a male-on-male partner. It's wrong. It shouldn't be happening. It has to stop. And that's what I'm concerned about.
Okay.
Is that no one has a right to victimize someone else, whatever your sexual orientation is.
Okay. Now, in that number of the male victims, are there children in there? Is there an age cap to that? I mean, do you go from, do you break down based on children and you pull that apart? And then when you start looking at from 18 up, is that done that way? You know, like I said, I'm asking questions because I don't know.
Right.
How is that done?
This 40% that the Center for Disease Controls and others have identified as male victims are adults.
Oh, these are adults. Children. Okay, so no children are counted in this number.
No, these are adults.
Okay.
Males who they're counting as being victimized. As with women, the 60% are women. Because they, when it comes to, this is interesting, when you define domestic violence, under the traditional definition of domestic violence, it talks about intimate partner relationships. They count children, the abuse of children, as child abuse. That's a separate set of numbers.
Okay.
That's why I frame it as family violence, because I count everybody.
Okay.
So my numbers look a little differently. I don't segregate adults from children.
And that's what I looked at in my research, that they were separating the adults from the children, so we don't even have an idea of what those children. I'm sure that numbers are high as well too.
Exactly. Because if you include it as a family violence instead of segregating it out from child abuse here, domestic violence here, you know, elder abuse over here, if you put it all together like I do when I'm studying and reporting those numbers, it looks horrific.
Right, exactly. Okay, now let me ask about a little bit about the history of looking at this and when professionals began to really look at domestic violence as it relates to males. Now, is that a new type of focus in terms of male? Because I know for a long time that there was nothing done about women who were being abused by their spouses. As a matter of fact, it was not until up into the late 20th century, from my historical research, that there had began to be a focus on men who were abusing their wives. And, you know, that whole rule of thumb comes out of that history. And the fact that it was believed, based on social mores, is that a man had a right to beat his wife. If she was acting up or didn't cook his dinner, then he could beat her as long as he didn't beat her with a stick bigger than his thumb, which was called the rule of thumb. And that was well up into the 20th century. And then just to add to that, in order to fight that, and women were trying to fight it, that's where the movement to stop alcohol being sold in bars was done out of that movement of women who were trying to stop men from getting drunk and then beat their wives. So the question is, what is the history of it as it relates to men? When did that become a focus, you know, of the health and human services area?
Well, actually, what you're speaking of in terms of that rule of thumb with women, I found some literature as recent as the mid-60s where men were still doing that. So I would say maybe towards the late early 70s, we began to see that shift to saying it's not okay to do that to your wife in the DV movement. Because actually, it was the civil rights movement that ushered in the domestic violence movement for women. And that's when that got ushered in. It's the civil rights movement ushered in the domestic violence movement. Okay? That's how that happened.
Wow.
So I would say within the past maybe 10 years, and I'm being really generous with that 10 year.
Mm-hmm.
I can go a little less. To say that we began to say, well, you know, men too, you know, maybe 5-6 years, you know, men too. But still, the reason I think that we've been delayed in saying it is because it's not that we knew it was happening, but because men weren't coming forward and reporting the numbers, even though we had this huge, you know, speak out, tell somebody campaign, you know, 20 years back, you know, 30 years back, maybe speak out, tell someone. Men were still reluctant to come forward and to speak out for all the reasons we just talked about. Well, more reasons that we're going to talk about in a minute.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. I want to get first to the history and the number part of it first.
We really just began to look at that. Yeah, quite honestly. We're really just starting to look at men, dealing with men as the perpetrator.
Right.
I mean, for maltreater treatment.
Okay.
You know. We're just doing that, really, several years.
Now, I also, in my research, I also found out that when the movement was ushered in to address domestic violence as it relates to women, it had to be done through the Cruelty to Animals Act, because there was no legislation, and in many cases, the statutory laws did not include husband and wife. And even in some cases, common law situations, it did not include that, you know, because in some states, the common law act was in effect, so you could live with the woman without having married to
her.
And then still some of the rules were there. So the question, I guess, I'm asking with this legislation being so old. And then the fact that now it's being coming in, what is it done based on studies to children and families? How does that really affect a family and children? What does it really do when a man is being abused? What devastation does that have that we can document and talk about?
Well, domestic violence, family violence, and its impact upon children is the same. It is, I mean, our ACE studies show us, you know, that that seeing that type of trauma being impacted within a household negatively impacts children, and it has a long-term, oftentimes lifetime impact, negative impact for children. And it doesn't really matter who the trauma is, if it's first, what we call first and secondary trauma. First trauma is that the violence is happening, say, directly to the child. Secondary trauma for domestic violence is that the child is witnessing the trauma happen to someone else. Be the child is witnessing the trauma happen to the male parent or the female parent. It's still the child being traumatized. So the impact is going to be the same.
Let's say, okay, because here's what I'm thinking about. And this is just really based on the way popular culture works. If there is a household where there's a husband and a wife, and say maybe two children, one male, one female, I wanted to know what kind of studies does it have an impact on a male child that's watching his daddy get beat by his mama? Because normally in popular culture, that's a cartoon. They've got jokes about stuff like that where the woman is so dominant that she beats the husband up. And it creates a laughing situation, and people don't take it seriously. So I'm just trying to put the seriousness to this. Where does that come in?
Well, let me give you the case studies that when I was a direct service provider for domestic violence families. Of course, those things are confidential, so I don't give any names. But in one particular case study where we had a situation where the wife was physically abusing the spouse, who happened to actually be a big guy, like, you know, 6 foot something, 200 and some pounds, you know, and she was like, you know, under 5'5".
Okay.
You know, but he would not hit her. He would not, you know, sometimes the best he would do was try to hold her to keep her from doing that. But if he were to sit down or something, she might come up behind him and hit him in the head with something or, you know, something of that nature. He didn't want to see her go to jail. They had children in the house, both male and female children in the house. It was something that I believe in this case, he tried to explain it to his children as mommy had some, you know, mental health issues. Whether that was true or not, I'm not a therapist. But I'm a domestic violence advocate, so I dealt with it from that point and, of course, made referrals for this particular family. But, of course, that did not set well with any of the children. They were being traumatized. It created a dynamic for that he wasn't comfortable with his son viewing. Another case study, it was the opposite. The father was doing it to the mother quite a bit. The son witnessed it. And what ended up happening in that situation, which is not unusual for children, the son ended up acting out and taking it out on the mother, who never harmed the child, but was very kind and responsive and loving towards the father, who was the abuser. Now, that's a coping mechanism.
Okay.
So what we were doing is trying to build resiliency with both sets of children. We were trying to build resiliency between the protective parent, which was the mom, who the child would take out his anger on her because she was safe. He knew she wouldn't retaliate, so the anger he felt for the dad, he would take out on the mom. So anybody on the outside looking at it would think the mom was the perpetrator or was the problem, and the child needs to be removed from the mom, when really that wasn't the situation. It was the dad.
Mm-hmm.
But children do this. These are different dynamics that they display. And if, to the untrained therapist, to the untrained school personnel, to the untrained police, to the untrained court, who doesn't get it, understand domestic violence, family violence dynamics, you will misinterpret that and make mistakes in terms of the placement of those children and which parent, for example.
Okay. All right. That's it. Now, who makes those rules and regulations governing all of this? Where is that coming from?
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Where do I begin? I mean, we can start with child protection. We can start even from first responders. We can start with police, who has to initially decide who's the perpetrator.
Okay.
Many times when police first responders come, they're just trying to figure out who's the perpetrator. Who is it? And it's usually like who's crying or who's yelling the most. I've seen victims, both male and female, who may not have, were actually the victims, but were the ones who were upset and who were yelling, and the perpetrator was the cool, calm one. be it male or female, they were cool and calm. They didn't get arrested. It was the first that was yelling and seemed out of control that the police arrested and thought was the perpetrator.
Okay.
Or because the victim was the person that didn't have the injury, but the perpetrator had the injury because the victim was trying to fight him off, be it male or female, and the wrong person gets arrested. We can start there.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'm going to, what I'm going to do is, because we want to do this in several parts, I'm going to go to our audience because I want to see if they have any questions about the beginning and, you know, the start of this and the whole historical connotations of it, you know, and then obviously some of the impact of male domestic abuse. I think I have an individual that's online that may be in that field. I don't know if they want to talk. But I will call on them. And if you're not, you don't have to say anything. We can just move on. 414-399. Would you like to add to this conversation? 414-399. Okay. All right. I was just listening. Let's go to a young lady that, you know, has supported us here at the Black Reality Think Tank over time. Still does. She is in this work of family violence and working with building and healing families. Ms. Ayan out of Greensboro. Ms. Ayan, you want to add to this conversation?
Need about 30 minutes.
Okay, she doesn't want to talk now. All right. Let me go to Brother Griffin. Brother Griffin, how you doing? Brother Griffin, are you there?
Are you there?
You okay?
Yeah, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, what do you have? You have anything you want to say or just listening?
I'm just listening. I came in a little late, but to be honest, she is spot on. I don't talk a lot about personal life, but I didn't have a son until I was 40. And by the time he was 7 years old, I had to leave because I can't stand, I grew up in that kind of environment. I can't stand putting your hands on somebody and then claim you love them. So she's talking exactly what I've experienced myself. I just don't go into a lot of detail.
Okay.
I don't understand the idea of beating and abusing and battering somebody you supposedly love.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, all right, I understand that. Okay, well, thank you. Okay. We come back.
Thank you.
What about my brother, Philadelphia? How are you doing?
Can you hear me, Dr. Rogers?
Yes, I can.
Yes, very good, sir. I'm on another phone. I hope you recognize that.
Yes.
My other phone went out. I'm going to say to the person that's on the phone, I like her conversation to the doctor. And I'm going to say that a book that I use that is a guide that I put next to my Quran, my Bible, and my Gita is Scheherazade Ali, The Black Man's Guide to Understanding the Black Woman.
Okay.
And, oh, yeah. And that book is very relevant because she says that in this slave culture they live in America, that the black woman, unfortunately, sees through the eyes of the white man, that she doesn't see the black man as a man. And what Scheherazade Ali is saying that she's been raised that way and that the white man has been like a foster parent to us, raising men and women. And she also has said that in all that goes on in domestic violence, that the black man may result in hitting the woman. She did not say that the black man should hit the woman. And she was winning her arguments in the 80s with her book. And people come on Phil Donahue and say, oh, she said the man should hit the woman. She never said that. Right. She talked about the things that her mouth, that came out of her mouth, that would cause the violence.
Exactly, exactly, exactly. Okay, all right. Let me see what our guest might have to say. Dr. Belger, you want to respond to that?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Let's talk. Well, what does it look like? I mean, for an abusive partner, when we talk about being abusing men, what does that look like? An abusive partner, they may kick, hit, bite, punch. They may throw things. They may destroy your possessions. I've seen people bleach folks' clothes, cut them up, whatever, set them on fire. I don't know. They'll do these things, particularly sometimes if they're women, they'll do them because they do these things because it makes up the difference in strength. You understand, men are physically more stronger. So the abuse may look different. The domestic violence may look different coming from women towards men. So the destruction of possessions is something that you'll often see because it makes up for that difference in strength. They may attack you while you're sleeping, or surprise you with that. I've seen, unfortunately, I buried men who have been shot, use of knives, or threatened with their children, or pet harm. Now, let me just say this as a full disclosure, because somebody is going to say, wait a minute, you didn't tell this part. So let me say this as full disclosure. Two things. One, I have two grown sons.
Okay.
Two grown men who I have raised by myself.
Okay.
And what I want you to understand, I love my sons, and I've raised them to be honorable and respectful Black men and to respect women, and they don't lay hands on women unless they pray for them. Mm-hmm. And that's it. So now if somebody put a knife through one of my sons, I'm going to be a little upset. Okay, and I'm going to have to hold some people accountable in this community for that. So I'm trying to raise honorable and respectful, wonderful women who honor and respect the wonderful Black men that I tried to raise and the others in these communities. I want us to have loving, healthy relationships so we can come out of the European construct for relationship and embrace the African construct for who we are and have healthier relationships and move from this place of violence. And we can do that. So this is what this is all about. This is why I do this work. And okay. For men who are in an abusive relationship, it's important for you to know that you're not alone, that this abuse happens to men far more often than you might than you might expect that it does. Okay?
Okay.
That there is a lack of resources for you. That's part of the research bears me out on this, Dr. Rogers. I have to say this piece. Because if you talk about why men don't come forward, where are they going to go? We don't even have trained advocates by far who are trained in understanding how to advocate for male victimization,
mm-hmm.
for domestic violence.
Mm-hmm.
I trained for it. I've been training for it. There is best practices for it. And this is why. Then you have shelters. Where are they going to go? With their children sometimes or by themselves. We don't really have shelters for men, survivors of domestic violence, to go either by themselves or to take their children.
Okay.
We don't have that advocacy for them. And that's what needs to change.
Right, right. That's powerful. I want to just call attention to our listening audience that we are here at the Black Reality Think Tank. This is a call-in format. Our call-in number is 215-490-9832. We welcome your calls with questions or comments that you have. Tonight we are talking about domestic violence as it relates to men victims. And we are looking at some of the causes, the who's, the what's, the why's, and the how's kind of situation, so we can better understand and obviously begin to work in this area as well. It's very important to do so. I very clearly, our guest tonight is Dr. Alice Belcher. She is a domestic violence advocate. She is a professor. She has written several books on this area, and she's using her expertise to really work in our community, and we really appreciate her and the effort in which she is putting forward, you know, in doing this. So if you have any questions, just give us a call. And what we will do is once you call in to the switchboard, you don't have to do anything further. I will see your number, and then I will ask you, do you wish to say something, or are you just listening? Because you can also use that number just to listen to our calls, listen to the conversation as well. But I will ask, I will be courteous and ask, do you want to say something? If not, you don't have to say anything at all, and I'll just move on. That's the way the process works here. But again, the Black Reality Think Tank is produced by the Sankofa Historical Society. It's sponsored by Motherland Media, and it is being aired on the TimeForAnAwakening.com network and the BlackTalkRadioNetwork.com. There are many programs that are on this system. They are various dialogues and talks and questions about all kinds of areas of African-American life. So by all means, we ask you to go to www.TimeForAnAwakening.com. And you can listen to any of the programs, pull down the podcast portal, and you can go in and listen to any of the broadcasts that were done previously. Most of our broadcasts are streamed live through that site on the days that they are supposed to come on. Like tonight, we can obviously hear us live if you are on the internet. And after this is over, you can go to the podcast and listen to a the recording that was done for this program. So we welcome you. We welcome you to do that, and we appreciate your effort for being here with us. There is a program that airs from our sponsor called African Perspectives. That program airs every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 to 1 Eastern Time. African Perspectives, 11 to 1 Eastern Time, and is hosted by Brother Oshi Amy Adelabu. And he dynamic program 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. African Perspectives, 11 to 1. And we do appreciate him and the things that he has done with his program. And we look forward to some more dynamic talk. Also on Friday and Sundays, we have Time for an Awakening, which is the managerial staff for the Time for an Awakening broadcast network. But they do have a program as well. It's called Time for an Awakening. And that's Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. They are there on Friday evenings from 8 to 10. And on Sundays from 7 to 10 Eastern Time, all Eastern Time. So you can listen to them live, call in, ask questions as well. Same number, 215-490-9832. And we do encourage you to do that. And you will surely be very well pleased with the outcome. I also talked to you about some upcoming programs that we're going to have. We're going to be talking about the great Harriet Tubman, but not only just in reference to the movie that's out. We want to talk about some of the research that was done on her, some of the incorrect research, and in some cases, I think, to debase her. And there's a couple of universities that have been focused on Harriet Tubman's vision, and it's just, and I think we as an African-American community need to be aware of that and talk about it. So we're going to talk about her. We have a young lady who has written a play, a one-act play on Harriet Tubman. She's going to be on there as our guest, and she'll be talking about her work and her vision. She's also a visual artist. She has done many pieces of artwork. She's preparing to do a traveling art exhibition, and so we want to talk about her and see what she has been doing. And then we are going to talk about the great Toni Morrison. We have a brother that is a Toni Morrison scholar. He's also a poet. And he has researched extensively Toni Morrison and her vision and her work and how she has used her fiction to tell the story of African-American life. So we're going to talk about it, talk to him and talk about Toni Morrison in an upcoming segment. So again, this is all here at the Black Reality Think Tank. Call in number 215-490-9832. We welcome your call. Okay, Dr. Belcher, I want to now go to the question, and I know you've been itching to talk about that. And the question is, why don't the brothers come forward? What are some of the reasons and causes? I know you've mentioned a few of them.
Well,
but let me finish. I want to go into it, and I want you to tell us what some of the reasons are, and then give me an opportunity to come back in some of the particular ones and ask you about them and what is it that you feel makes that the way it is. So why don't you begin by telling us, what are some of the reasons that the brothers don't come forward who are being domestically abused?
Well, okay, because you went out a little bit. I didn't quite hear you. You asking me reasons why they don't leave?
No, why don't they seek help?
Oh, why they don't seek? Well, number one is reason, according to research, is denial. Just as with, like,
you
with
said
denial, just like with female domestic violence victims, denying that there's a problem in your relationship.
Okay, I got you.
You
I
know,
you. Okay.
They may still love their partner, you know, when they're not being abusive. You okay. know, they believe that person's going to change and they can help them change or whatever. If you're, you know, if you're in a same sex relationship, and you haven't come out to your family or friends, and you're afraid that your partner is going to out you, you know, that's mm-hmm. another reason.
Right. Okay.
You know, if you want to protect your kids, you know, you're worried your spouse is going to maybe harm your kids, you know, or prevent you from having access to them, custody issues. You know, there's the feeling of shame. Many men feel great shame that they've been abused and been unable to stand up for themselves, or they feel that they somehow failed as a male, as a role model as a male or as a husband or as a father. Religious reasons. You know, a lot of it is faith. You'd be surprised how strong faith plays a part in some of those reasons. But one of the key reasons that the research also shows, and I got to keep coming back to it, that is the lack of resources. I'm telling you, when I say resources, I'm talking advocates, trained advocates in the victimization of men in domestic violence. Many men worry that they'll have difficulty being believed by authorities, mm-hmm. or that their mm-hmm. abuse is going to be minimized because they're a man. And then, you know, where are they going to go?
Mm-hmm.
There's so few resources to specifically help abused men. That's our reality.
Okay. Do us a favor and explain to, give us the definition, the technical definition for domestic violence. In order for someone to be ascribed to be a victim of domestic violence, what had to happen?
Well, I'm just going to paraphrase it for the state of Wisconsin. Basically, it's whenever there is a physical or threats of violence, physical actual violence or threats of violence or things like that between an intimate partner who you've lived with, been married to, or have a child in common. That's defined as domestic violence in the state of Wisconsin.
Okay, so, you know, so if your wife...
The state defines it a little differently.
If your wife tells you, and I'm speaking from the man perspective, if your wife tells you, I'm going to smack the crap out of you,
that's a threat of violence.
And so what can you do if she says
that's
that?
That's DV.
Say it again?
That's a threat of physical harm.
And so what can happen in the state of Wisconsin if she says that to you, what can you then do? Call the police?
You can call them. You can always call the police for any and everything. I mean, you can call them.
Uh-huh.
You can walk away. You can leave. You can do a lot of things.
I tell victims this.
If somebody threatens you, if they threaten you, you know, believe them. I mean, if somebody says to you, for example, something even harsher, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to believe you for one thing. I'm going to take you at your word. And I'm going to act accordingly. I never, as a domestic violence advocate, we never tell victims what to do.
Okay.
We give them, we say to them, this is what you can do to be safe. This is, we can't guarantee your safety if you do, you know, do. But we never tell them what to do. They spent their whole life or whole relationship having somebody tell them what they can and cannot do. Our job is to empower them to be able to make good choices or to make their own choices and to scaffold them with knowledge to be able to make a choice for themselves.
Okay.
We don't tell victims what to do.
All right. I'm trying to, I want to make sure for our audience that we get a very clear picture of this. Now, here's another scenario. Okay. Considering the way that men are viewed in this culture that we live in, and what a man is and what he's supposed to be in his culture and the way he's, looked upon and the way he acts in the culture as a man and being able to be called a man. So if I then went to the barbershop to get a haircut and I told the guys in there, look, hey man, my wife told me she was going to smack the SHIT out of me. What am I going to do? I'm scared. What am I going to do?
Okay.
Work that out for me.
So what you're speaking to is, how can an abused male protect himself? Okay. So I would preface it by saying this. There's many ways of dealing with an abusive partner. I said some of it a minute ago. You could leave if possible. Okay. Beware of the signs, the triggers, the violent responses. You can leave. Be ready to leave quickly. You know, make a plan to always be able to get ready to get out. You know, call emergency services, police, those things. Never retaliate. An abusive partner may try to provoke you into retaliating or using force, you know, try to make you hit them, try to make you fight. You can get evidence of the abuse. You report all incidences to the police, no matter how small, because sometimes what happens is people think, oh, this happened, but it's been happening for how long? 6 years or 6 months, but did you ever report it? Because if you keep reporting the small incidences,
what it does, it creates a pattern of behavior that the police can go back and see, oh, this has been going on for a while. Keep a mobile phone. Keep evidence of the abuse. You know, things of that nature. There are ways that you can begin to protect yourself as an abused male. The same things that happen for abused females. It's not much different.
Okay, so as an advocate, as a domestic violence advocate, how does someone get to you? How are you? Are they referred to you? Do they seek you out? Are you in the telephone book? What happens? What has to take place in order for you to step in the picture?
Well, we do have domestic violence hotlines that people can call, and the National Domestic Violence Hotline, you can call that number and they will refer you directly to, you know, your most local agency, local where you are, so no matter where you are in the country. It's 1-800-799-7233. 1-800-799-7233.
Okay.
And they will, you call that 800 number and they will refer you right away. It's the hotline. Or just if you're on the website, thehotline.org, just type thehotline.org. You can chat with somebody right away and they'll give you referrals to, you know, where you are.
Okay.
Since I know you're broadcasting everywhere, Dr. Roger, that's why I just give you the National Domestic Violence Hotline.
Okay. Now, again, I wanted to put a handle on this and to make it so that we can...
But if you wanted our particular services at Impact Coalition for Families, because what we do, you know, and we come in and we provide training so that we can fill this void, fill this gap for resources. Now, the resources that I keep coming back to this is trained domestic violence advocates. And I want you to understand, domestic violence advocates are different. A lot of times people think, oh, domestic violence advocates, they're all the same. No, they're different advocates. There's what I call one of five. There are advocates who help with transition. You know, those are the abuse survivors, domestic violence help, you know, to get you, navigate you through the legal system, shelter, start a new life.
Okay.
Then there's advocates who help with support.
I see.
You know, they do the counseling. First, you know, victims work with them oftentimes to construct, you know, plans and so forth. Then there's domestic violence advocates who just help with children. Cases of advocates, they'll arrange for children to speak with psychologists and therapists and qualified professionals, work with them for resiliency with parents. I talked to that earlier. Then there's advocates who help with legal needs.
Okay.
You know, attorneys act as domestic violence advocates. I train a lot of attorneys to understand this dynamic so they know what they're looking at in court to work with those victims.
Okay.
And then there's advocates who help promote change. That's what I am. I'm a domestic violence change agent. So in addition to advocating and assisting victims, these domestic violence advocates, we educate the public and we advocate for legislative change. And we do public education and we work in a variety of settings, including schools and community centers. And we give speeches and offer presentations and provide information to the public of what domestic violence is and what to do if you're or a loved one or a victim of it. And we advocate and we lobby for legislative change to work towards improving the rights of domestic violence victims.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there's different type of DV advocates.
Okay. So in order to be involved and to be able to access a domestic violence advocate, the victim has to have been threatened or either physically abused. Am I correct?
No, you can call 1-800-799-7233 anytime you feel that you need advocacy, because the person, if you feel threatened, that's a legitimate. No one can define for you that that's not legitimate. If you feel you need an advocate, then you need one. You don't need for me to define that for you.
So
you know how you feel. You know how that other person makes you feel. If you need to talk to somebody for them to help identify for you what you're feeling, you can call that number. And they will refer you to hopefully trained advocates
to
work with you and walk you through that.
That's a lot clearer then. Okay, because I'm trying to determine what is the standard for what makes that person eligible to receive you know, that kind of thing. What has to happen? You said feel violent or either threatened or either an actual abuse situation. So it doesn't have to be that it's just he or she. I mean, he gets physically abused to the max. There is some other areas that have to be considered. Is that correct?
No, no, yes, because if someone's verbally abusing you or belittling you or humiliate you in front of friends or colleagues or family or on social media, that's abuse. If they're being possessive or acting jealous and harassing you or constantly accusing you of being unfaithful, they're taking away your keys or your medication to control you or where you go or who you see or how you spend your money or deliberately, you know, controlling all your finances or making false allegations about you to friends or to employers or manipulating or isolating you or threatening to leave you or to prevent you from seeing your kids or going to threaten to kill themselves. All of these things are DV. It's domestic violence if your partner is doing it.
That really appears to be a thin line. That's a real thin line. I mean, because you think about it in the in a marital situation. I mean, the people say stuff all the time when they're arguing. I'm gonna leave you, you know, and you can't, you know. I mean, you could take it serious, but it just seems to be a thin line there. I'm not denying it at all. I'm just saying it just seems to be a thin line.
That is exactly part of why Impact Coalition for Families does so much. We do a lot of free community education. We do community coffee and conversation, which we started this summer, where it's an avenue by which we funnel free community education bi-monthly here in the Milwaukee County area, because we want to address what's normal and what's not normal.
Okay.
Because you've been doing it, I don't know, 600 years, 400 years, I don't know. Because you've been doing it don't mean it's right.
Okay. Okay.
Doesn't mean it's normal.
Okay. All right. Okay, I'm going to go to the our lines again. Sister Yana, I saw you went off and came back on. Are you interested in saying something now?
Yes, I'll say a little something. Good evening, Dr. Rogers.
Good evening.
How are you? Hello?
Hello, I'm here.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Greetings, Dr. Belcher. How are you?
Oh, wait just a second. I wanted her to use her. Okay, Dr. Belcher, she spoke to you.
Oh, I said hi. I'm so glad to hear your voice again.
Same thing here. I've been listening, and there's some good information, very important information that's been shared. So we need it. We need all the help that we can get.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks, Dr. Belcher, for what you do. I'm just really glad when I hear people that are doing the work. That's just critical. So I just want to talk a little bit about those that are victimized. Because as I shared in the past, my work is primarily working with the victims and the victim mindset. And it's not being critical, but having been a victim of domestic violence myself, you know, at some point, I had to look at myself and ask why I was tolerating what I was tolerating and how I was going to get out of that thing. And what was going on with me that I chose a person that had those issues. So I might be jumping around. I might jump around a little bit. But so oftentimes, people that are abusers, they show signs early on. They're angry people. They get angry quickly. They might have a temper. They, you know, maybe have a tendency to lie. They're just different signs. If we look close enough and get to know a person before we get deeply involved, we can see some signs.
Okay.
A lot of times we ignore the signs and get into a situation that, you know, becomes explosive. So what I'm saying is that there's a certain level of responsibility that the victimized have to take. A lot of people always ask, you know, why don't you leave? Why don't you leave? A lot of times people don't know why. And Dr. Belcher talked some earlier about that. But the person that's being victimized has to understand themselves why they're in an abusive situation once they're in it. I will talk a little personally. I have a family member that was, we were in a therapy session, and he was a young man, and he has such anger issues. He has a tendency to explode. And so I know that this young man, once he starts getting into relationships, he's going to beat somebody. Mm. He's 17 or 18, but I know he's going to beat somebody. And so back to the therapy session, we're sitting in a session, family session, and he's angry at his mother, but in his mind, he cannot, which is correct, he cannot hit his mother. And then he looks at me, and he tries to, you know, throw some venom at me, and then he realizes he can't hit me. And so he turns to the person that's right beside him and attacks him physically, just so quickly, wow, you know, in the blink of an eye. Hey. And so that angry energy, we have to be able to detect that, because oftentimes, you know, it can save your life.
Oh, that's really, that's powerful.
So I'm stopping there.
How do you treat something like that? Let me ask you, how do you look at treating? Then I want Dr. Belcher to answer that as well. How would you treat that?
Well, first and foremost, to find out what's going on with a person.
Okay.
Because most abusers have been abused.
Right.
That's, you know, many abusers don't know how to deal with their anger or the pain that's underneath the anger, whatever's underneath the anger. They can't articulate their feelings. A lot of people are not able to say, I'm really angry at you, and this is why, you know, and verbalize a thing and get it out.
Okay.
And so that energy goes into hitting.
Okay.
So the way that we deal with it is to allow people spaces to talk about their childhoods, again, which is oftentimes where the violence starts, where they introduce the violence or have been beaten, and express their feelings about it. And that's just not an easy thing, because so many of us have this message in our heads, you know, don't talk about what happened to you,
okay,
especially as a child.
Mm-hmm.
Don't talk about your mother being an angry black woman who cussed you out like a dog and beat you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And a lot of times, one more quick thing, that happens to a lot of young black men raised by mothers who are angry,
mm-hmm,
for various reasons, and they take the anger out on the child. And then that young man, I've seen so much of this, grows up to be an emasculated young man, or the opposite, you know, just overly aggressive, but oftentimes emasculated. And then he links up with the woman who sees that as a weakness, and that's where a lot of times you see your female on male violence.
Good point. Good point. That's an excellent point. Dr. Belcher, how would you treat, mm-hmm, a situation like that? But first, let me just indicate to our audience, if you'd like to ask a question or make a comment, our number is 215-490-9832. So, Dr. Belcher, how would you address that issue of the angry young man?
Well, as an advocate, you know, helping, you know, like I said earlier, there are advocates who are or should be specifically trained to help with children. As it relates to child resiliency training, they should have child resiliency training, you know, to help children to care for those children as a domestic violence advocate, and to provide them the support that those children need for resiliency. And in other cases, like, you have to remember, I'm going back to this, domestic violence advocates are not necessarily trained therapists. Now, you can be a trained therapist who happened to go through training as a domestic violence advocate, okay? But we are not, domestic violence advocates are not therapists. So in many of these cases, what we do, we go through child resiliency training and group therapies and individual things, working with them with parents. And in other cases, as an advocate, we'll arrange for these children to speak with a child psychologist or another qualified professional.
Okay.
But this is the other thing that we do with those parents. This is why we, you know, we never tell victims what to do, but we tell them, show them the consequences that they've already experienced and some of the reasons why.
Okay.
So we support, so the support from family to move on from abusive relationships,
okay,
is what is necessary. You know, if you
all
can,
right,
get the support from your family and friends, as well as counseling, therapy, support groups for domestic violence survivors that can help you move on from an abusive relationship, you may struggle, you know, with some upsetting emotions, and you're going to feel numb, you're going to feel a little disconnected. and you might not be able to trust people very much at the beginning after this trauma of the abuse. It can take a while to get over that pain and memory, including your children, but you can heal, you can move on.
Okay.
But even if you're eager to jump into a new relationship and finally get into intimacy, think of your children, think of yourself, and the support you've been missing. So it's wise to take those things slowly for yourself, for your children. Make sure you're aware of any those red flags that got you in the behavior in the first place, or not being able to recognize the abuser until you're in it. Sometimes they hide it. They're not always angry at the beginning. There's that honeymoon stage. They're just the salt of the freaking earth, you know, until you're in it. And
okay.
it happens gradually, okay?
Okay.
So before you jump into a new partner with those kids or with yourself, take the time you need to build a healthy relationship, and that's going to help you and your kids long term.
Okay, call a 414-2324. You have a comment or question in this discussion. Call a 414-324. Okay, just listening. All right, that's fine. Okay, let me ask you, Dr. Belcher. You indicated that you had written a curriculum. You know, for domestic violence advocates, what are some of the goals and objectives of that curriculum that you would hope to see employed once a person goes through the course of the study?
Well, one of some of the goals of that curriculum, and we did a 6-year pilot program in partnership with Springfield College School of Human Services at the time here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and it was very successful. We trained, I want to say maybe close to 100 people who actually got a certificate from the college and from Impact Coalition for Families jointly. We trained law enforcement. We trained therapists, psychologists. We trained PhD educators. We trained principals. We trained, sexual assault, same nurses. We
okay.
trained domestic violence advocates, sexual assault advocates who were already working in the field.
Okay.
And what we heard from them was like, oh my God, I needed this before I had this job, and thank God for you. And it was very successful. And we brought in those advocates. Many of those advocates who are already out there in the field gave, you know, to come in and teach these classes. So it was just wonderful. And what we were trying to do, I had one psychotherapist who said, I was writing the DSM for the state of Wisconsin for DV. And she says, oh my God, I was writing it wrong.
Okay.
There is no DSM for DV like that. There is not. And she was writing one for the, and so she, it helped her to recognize that it was all wrong and she was doing a disservice to victims. That was the whole core premise of doing this best practices research, was to say, look, what we're doing is causing, it was causing re-victimization of victims within the system here in Wisconsin. And we were doing the very best we could. We thought we were doing it right. And in many cases, we did it very well. But in a lot of too many cases, we were doing it wrong and we were re-victimizing victims. So and we had a lot of people out there saying, I'm an advocate. And you were doing this stuff on your own. And they are doing it. Believe me, people are doing this stuff. They're doing it in their basements, in their garages, in their churches, in their houses. They're doing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's no sense in us putting our head in the sand talking about, we got this on lock that we're the gatekeepers to DV and SA in Wisconsin or New York or no other state. Let me tell you something. These people are doing this because they need it.
Right.
So what the whole core premise was to take a nationally recognized curriculum, a standardized curriculum and a training approach and say, here is something. In the state of Wisconsin, Wisconsin is one of those few states that does not require domestic violence advocates to go through training. And you have to have me on again for me to go into that reason why, because that's a whole program. I can really talk about that.
Right.
But for time's sake, it's needed because people are out here dilly-willy doing it anyway because they need it. The community is crying for it, and there was no standard curriculum.
And is that,
so that's why I did it.
And is that some of the things that you were talking about, that's resources that are missing? Is that a
Thank
part of
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
That's the missing resources.
Okay.
And I have it. And we did it, and we piloted it for 6 years, and it was successful. And people have been clamoring me for it again, which is why I began doing the community coffee and conversations bi-monthly. But even that isn't enough, so now I'm getting ready to go back full-blown here in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee County, and just do it again.
Right.
Because I'm doing it in other places outside the state, but here at home.
Okay.
And I'm just saying, look, I'm not going to apologize for this anymore. It's necessary, and the gatekeepers, beware. And
okay.
I'm just serious, because my phone is ringing off the hook.
Okay. So if a male...
men who are not being served.
So if a male who wouldn't know that these resources are missing, and you indicated one of the reasons that they don't come forward is because there's not enough resources, but they wouldn't know that. In terms of whether or not they were choosing to come forward or to not respond to it at all.
They know, because some of them are calling me saying, you know what, I went to so-and-so, and they said they don't serve men.
Okay, oh, I see, okay.
I went to so-and-so, so I can't get in that shelter.
Okay.
I went to so-and-so.
All right, so if there's a young man out there now that's listening to us, or say someone who knows a young man, or male, not just young man, a male in general, who is being abused but has not chosen to come forward, what advice as an advocate would you give to either the person that's going to assist them to come forward, or the male that's listening right now who hasn't come forward? Walk him through that process of what he needs to do.
I would want him to get to, my first question to him is, do you feel safe where you are?
No, but he hasn't got to you yet. He's at home listening to us right now.
That's what I'm saying. If he's listening to me right now, I'm saying if you don't feel safe where you are, you need to leave.
I see. Okay, I got you. Uh-huh.
You need to get in a safe environment. You can call me. You can call the 1-800 number. My number is, now I don't mind giving it out.
Give it up, please, if you can.
414-236-0749, and I'll walk you through.
Okay. And then
we'll get you referred to help.
And then just give that individual who still may be a little reluctant, I don't want to call nobody. They're going to get in my business. You know, so take them through the process of why they need to call you and what is it that they can look forward to once they do call you. Go to that extent.
If you're reluctant to contact a stranger, and I can understand that, think about if there is a family member or a close friend that you can confide in, that maybe you haven't, you know, then you can try to get you counseling. If you contact me or therapy or advocates, I will try to find you an advocate that will see you, that will take care of you, walk you through process. For your abuse as a survivor, it can help you move from this abusive relationship if you so desire. Whatever you desire, I would also tell you that as a survivor, you will have to tell me what you want. We never tell survivors what to do or what you want. I will help scaffold you through what you want to be safe.
Okay. All right. Now, okay, just to give us a window to look at this, what would you tell a woman?
Same thing.
Okay, so there's no difference in the instruction base?
Nope.
Okay, just to come forward. Now, just for informational purposes, and I know we talked about it, why are women reluctant to come forward? Is it the same reason?
Most of the same reasons, but a little bit different, too. Sometimes the added piece can be, it's the same thing, but sometimes the added piece can be finance. Sometimes the women are, we find, you know, but within the research shows that a lot of times the women have sometimes the lesser of the money. There are some cases where women make a lot more, but that's not the norm. You know, usually he has more of the control or the finance or the care of the family, and that's usually a big thing, because sometimes women will leave or whatever, but they usually end up coming back.
Right.
You know, shelters are either inadequate, or, and by that I mean this, let me just going to use the African-American female. predominantly in our families as a norm, we feed our kids when they're hungry, right? You know, I'm hungry, okay, we go in the kitchen and feed them. We don't care if it's 9 o'clock at night, they're hungry. But when you're in shelters and you don't have that flexibility, you don't have the dynamics, that's just one thing about being culturally responsive. So, and then there's the other pieces to that. You know, if you have a child, maybe a male son who's 16, 17, where are you going? Can you get in that shelter? I mean, there's a lot of reasons why women come back. Mm-hmm. You understand?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What is the healing process? Can we talk about a healing process for domestic violence victim, male, particularly male?
Well, I touched on it just a little bit. Men, I would say, I said it a little earlier, don't jump into a new relationship and get out into an intimacy, and things like that. Just take things slowly, okay? You know, make sure that you're aware of any red flags that you may have missed the first time, you know.
Okay.
But
I think I'm talking
like
more the clinician area. What
well, is, you, no, I'm not, no, again, I'm not
and
a
I know, I know you're I not, I know you're an advocate, but I'm just saying, I'm sure you have some knowledge of what the clinician process is for a domestic
violence abuse. You really have to understand, you really need to sit and analyze, okay, I've been in this relationship, you have to come out of the denial. And sometimes just because you left doesn't mean you're out of the denial. Sometimes victims still go, well, what did I do? Maybe if I had done this differently, maybe if I had done that differently, you know, maybe we could still make it work. They still are trying to process what really happened.
Uh-huh.
What happened to me? And sometimes that can take years.
So that's that's what the clinician does?
You're asking me about the healing process, and I'm saying it can take years. And a lot of that is just peeling back the onion to understanding who you are, what that relationship was, why you were in it, why you stayed so long,
right.
You know, why are you, out of it now? How is it going to take you to walk back to who you really are? Who are you really?
Okay, I got you.
And how not to get into another.
All right.
And that could take years.
Okay.
And sometimes healing just looks like learning to live with what you've been through. Oftentimes it is.
Okay.
Sometimes people think healing is, I'm just over it. No, sometimes you're healing most times. Mm-hmm. It's going to look like you've just learned to live with it and be able to move on progressively in your life.
So the therapist then, I know you're not a therapist, you're an advocate. So the therapist then in that process is more looking at the cause and effect type of thing, or is the therapist looking to try to heal? I need to understand what is the healing.
Well, let me. Uh-huh. I will share with you this. As an advocate, when I refer clients on, and I do that a lot, I take them as far as we have goals that we set when they first come in. You know, we have goals that they set. You tell me, we set them together, and it's liquid. You know, it's not actually stone. It's liquid. It's fluid. But when we've kind of gone through that process and we don't have a set time, we don't give them 30 days, 1 year, however long they need to be.
Right.
When they kind of let me know when they're ready to go, and we kind of feel it. And sometimes it's like, I've taken you kind of as far as I can go. I think where you're stuck right here, maybe we can bring in some therapy or a therapist. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about signing a release? You know, I know what my limitations are. And part of my training process and my curriculum is I teach advocates to know when you hit that wall and when it's time to refer them on.
Okay. Well, the reason I'm asking that question and I'm harping on that is that, again, for the very reason that we are doing the talk program tonight about this, is if there's somebody out there, I want to kind of give them a window to look at how they can be helped and what is that process going to be like. Because, like, say, if I had some kind of an ailment and you would tell me to go to a doctor, therapist, first thing I ask you, well, what do they do? Is he going to give me pills? Or is he going to do this? Or is he going to do that? I would want to have some idea. I mean, you can't obviously tell me specifically what he's going to do, but I would want to know I would want to have some idea of, what I can look for. Like, say, for instance, I know someone told me, everybody should have a colostomy check. And I said, well, what is that? What do you do? How does that work? You know, and then they ended up trying to tell me. And then they said, oh, by the way, it's very painful, too. I said, oh, okay, there we go. Oh, okay. You know, kind of thing like that. So that's why I'm asking. I'm asking because we have somebody out here that's listening. If they're listening, I want them to be comfortable in knowing that they can get help and that this help is going to do some good. So, okay. Now
well, what I want to say to you is that domestic violence advocacy is survivor-driven. Again, we don't tell them what to do. We help them to scaffold their way to a better way of living. We help them. Now, to flip this, many times, and there have been many times I've gotten referrals to me, to our agency, from medical.
Okay.
From a medical physician who had somebody come in for an injury, and they did their medical assessment for DV, and they said, oh. And they said, well, you know, because we left our information, whatever, oh, well, we have a place you can go. So we've gotten them from medical. We got them, like, in reverse. And I've gotten them referrals from people who went to see a therapist. And okay. A therapist was like, ooh, they've gotten a release and said, I told this person, yeah, I'm going to treat you. We're going to talk about these things. But I've had therapists call me with the release of faxing. I said, fax it to me. Are they with me? They fax me the release. And we're on three-way right away.
Right.
The therapist, the you know, the victim of the survivor, and me. Because the therapist realized, okay, I can do this, but I need an advocate for that. Because I'm not a trained DV advocate.
Okay.
So I work in partnership with medical, with therapists, and advocates. We all have our role.
Okay, what is the difference in all those there? What is a medical versus a therapist? What is the difference in the two?
Well, if she goes to the doctor because her eye, you know, she's, you know, her orbital bone is cracked because he hit her in it so forcefully, well, he's going to x-ray and give her some medical, okay? I can't do that. If she goes to a therapist and trying to figure out why this is her 15th abusive relationship, and she's trying to unpeel that onion that's going to take maybe I don't know how long, the therapist is going to help with that. I can't help with that.
Okay.
But now she wants to talk about how she's going to, you know, be able to safely get out of the abusive relationship, safely maybe get back to her family,
okay.
Maybe, you know, get into a new place, you know, get back in school, woo, 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 maybe have someone accompany her to the court. She doesn't want to go alone. That's me.
That's advocates. Okay. Now, what's medical?
Right.
What does a medical do in the domestic violence
The medical is going to treat the physical.
Or you mean
any physical injury.
The injuries itself.
Yeah, any physical injury.
Could that be considered psychiatry as well? Is that considered?
That's therapy. That's therapist.
Okay, psychiatry would be the therapist. And the medical
therapist,
would be just the person that's treating the injuries.
The physical.
Right.
Yeah,
okay.
The injurer.
And so that's
we've gotten referrals from both, thank God.
Okay.
See, that's the team. That's the whole premise. Back to what your earlier question about the curriculum I wrote. It's written to design. I'm training all of those individuals to work as a team, each one reach one, teach one,
okay.
To work as a team to prevent domestic violence.
Okay.
And the one other element was the police.
Okay. All right. All right, Brother Timothy, what you got any questions you want to add on to this?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Two cases, sir. And one was a case where the two women that came from the home of abusing both of their husbands, one worked for corporations as a salesperson. She was a manager. And she used to threaten the employees with sexual comments, smacking them on the buttocks. All this was recorded.
Mm-hmm.
And the other men would laugh like, what's wrong with you? That's okay. One guy said, look, the ones who like it get promoted. The ones who don't, she tries a way to fire them.
Mm-hmm.
So she took her abuse from her household to her job. The other one was a correctional officer.
Mm-hmm.
She did it in the prison. And she was even, unfortunately, having intercourse with the men.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the abusiveness of power that she brought from the household to both of them brought to the job.
Okay. That's clear. Abusing her, obviously her role as an employer, and created that kind of trauma. And I was looking, Dr. Belcher, you know, for you to use the word trauma. I was looking for trauma. Where does that come in? Who determines that? Is that the therapist or the medical person? Who determines if there's trauma involved?
Well, we do assessments. Whenever we've been contacted by a survivor, we use lethality assessment. We use the Jacqueline Campbell lethality assessment, which assesses if you're in immediate danger, being killed, whatever. And then there's other assessments for imminent danger, and other assessments we use for potential harm and things like that.
And so who's doing that? The therapist?
These are domestic violence assessment tools that we have.
I'm saying, who administers
them? We have
that?
Those. We use those. And therapists may use those, and maybe they use some others as well. Like medical doctors have medical assessment tools that they use in emergency rooms, hospitals, and clinics that they use to assess DV. Okay. And domestic violence advocates, we have assessment tools that we use for lethality assessments and so forth and so on. So, yeah. So it's all, scientifically designed. Okay. So that we can assess the situation, then we can better advocate for you. All of us do.
Okay.
All of us do.
All right. Brother Timothy, you want to add something else on that?
No, sir. I want to listen because you brought on a person that we have to see the other side of these things. Just like the women are abused, so are the men.
Okay. All right. And that's true. I'm learning that. This has been very informational for me. Well, I'm sorry, go right ahead.
I was going to say, sir, it's the thing of a power. Power.
Yeah, you're right.
And I think,
power.
Right, mm-hmm. Right. And I think when it comes in that, when a person sees that they're losing control, they'll try to get it to put this person back in place by any means they could do it.
Right.
The women does it, the women do it, and the men can do it.
Men do it. You're right.
We live in that type of society now.
Exactly. Okay. Mm-hmm. Dr. Belcher, you got about 5 minutes. Time flies so fast when you're having a good time, but I really appreciate the information you provided us. What would you like to say in closing? And maybe you can give us that number again in case there is someone listening who may need to talk further and want to be more intimate in terms of the questions that they ask. Can give them that number again. And then tell us about the book just quickly, because, you only got 5 minutes. The two books that you wrote,
I would just like to say that domestic violence it continues to constitute an enormous public health problem here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And our ability to understand and acknowledge the complexities involved in it is significant, and we must do that through education.
Okay.
You can get my books at my website. It's alicebelcher.com, www.alicebelcher.com. There's information out there about upcoming conference I'm having in November and other things, and the community coffee and conversation that we do bi-monthly. I've written a book on domestic family violence prevention for the African-American communities. We'll be releasing shortly the Family Violence Healing, People Broken by Violence, the Family Violence Systemic Abuse, Revictimization and Unintended Consequences, and the Family Violence, the Church Role and Responsibility. If you want to reach me by phone directly, again, my number is 414-236-0749. I'll be glad to come in. I do training. I do development, set up your cohorts. We need